I thought you'd never wake up. I completely failed to catch on at first, but then again, I had hit my head. Where am I? I tried to ask, but it came out more like a woof. Holmes burst into tears, putting a hand to her mouth. Her nails were painted a bright red, and she smelled like forever, ever cotton candy. Then I noticed she was in a polka-dot sweater, with a bow in her hair. Apparently she'd been working on her caring girlfriend routine. I thought I was going to be sick, but then it might have been the concussion. I was fairly sure I had one. Everything was out of focus in a doubled sort of way, and the only solution I could think of was to sleep. I shut my eyes, satisfied that I'd fulfilled my end of our makeshift plan. I had an injury that was bound to keep me in the infirmary for at least a day, enough time for Holmes to poke around. Somewhere across the room, a voice said, "Oh, you two are too much," and I snapped my eyes open again. From the little supply station, Nurse Bryony beamed at us. "Do you know she hasn't left your side for the past 3 hours? You blacked out for a bit, and then you were drifting between asleep and awake, and the whole time she just sat and held your hand, fretting. Poor thing." The accent was American, but the cadences were faintly, unmistakably English. I don't know how I hadn't noticed it before, or was it in my head? This time, if I ignored the halos I saw around all the lights and the soft little hum in my head, I could almost pay attention. "How long will he be here?" Holmes asked, laying her hand against my cheek. "We have dinner reservations for tomorrow in town. It's our 2-month anniversary." Her fingers were cool and soft against my face, and I found myself leaning into her touch. Then I froze. "Sorry," I whispered to her, mortified. "What are you apologizing for?" she asked, her voice surprisingly rough-edged. With her other hand, she brushed my hair back from my face. The nurse cleared her throat, cutting into my confusion. "I'll keep a close eye on him. It's not bad enough to send him to the hospital, but I still don't want to take chances. You might have to reschedule your plans, just to be safe." Holmes smiled down at me. She wasn't Haley. She was something much more insidious. Charlotte Holmes, without the edges, all combed and clean, well-loved and loving in return. I knew it would be gone tomorrow, all of it. The gentle way she touched me, the glitter of her undivided attention, the bows and the perfume. It would all go back into her costume box, and she would be the real Holmes again. Because this wasn't real, even if she spoke to me in what sounded like her real voice. "Do you hear that? You should be fine," she said. I shouldn't have wanted it the way I did. I was beginning to go, I could tell, and I knew I would wake up back into our old life. The lights winked at me. They liked the secrets I told them. But silently I reminded myself secrets are best when kept to oneself. They began blowing out, one by one, like candles. "Good night," I told Holmes, pulling her hand to my chest, and then I was awash in sleep. "Watson," she hissed. "Watson, wake up. I've got to go. Night check's in 10 minutes. The room was dark, but I could see light coming in from under the door where the nurse's desk was. Thankfully, it seemed my head had cleared enough to form coherent sentences. "Did you find anything?" I asked, or tried to ask. It came out cotton-mouthed. Holmes handed me a glass of water with an impatient look. I was right. She was herself again, and I suppressed a flare of disappointed guilt. After a gulp, I repeated my question. "She went out for a smoke, and I picked the lock on the medicine cabinet. There's a store of protein powder in with the other prescriptions, for Gabriel Tinker, according to the tag, but the canisters were all empty. I tasted a bit of powder I found in the cabinet, and it seemed innocent enough." Tinker was the rugby team's fly half, the one who'd been sleeping on the field. "You tasted it? Why couldn't you take it back to your lab and examine it there?" She looked affronted that I should even ask. "Efficiency?" "Right, okay, you nut. I pulled myself slowly into a sitting position. Holmes tucked a pillow behind my back. So, let's break it down. She's from England, that's why we flagged her file originally, right? She was born there, but she moved here when she was a teenager, or so she said when I pressed her, after I shed a few homesick tears. My face is still swollen. I forgot how uncomfortable this whole crying business is. No powder, no England. Two near misses, then, I said. Unless you somehow wronged her back when you were a toddler, if I've got her age right. 22? 23. Holmes got to her feet. If she is, in fact, our culprit, she wouldn't be telling the truth to us anyway, so it hardly matters. As it stands, I can tell she's hiding something, but that could just be the sort of reserve you have around students. I'll try to track down an actual sample of that powder tomorrow, because what I tried tasted more like dust than protein. Shouldn't we focus on someone who we have a clear lead on? Like, I don't know, August Moriarty? No, I don't think so, she said matter-of-factly. I'm off to write my Macbeth paper. Be careful tonight, and maybe shower. You smell awful. When she left, I realized I was starving. I wolfed down a roll of crackers I found next to the bed and took the small cup of what looked like Tylenol, washing it down with the rest of the water. As I set the glass carefully back down on the table, depth perception was a bit of an issue post-concussion, I realized what I'd done. The woman taking care of me might be a poisoner, with a fixation on me and Holmes, and I'd put myself into her overnight care, tossing back the pills she gave me without a second thought. The light in the next room flicked off. I stared at the door, willing it to stay shut, willing the nurse to pack up her things and leave. I willed this feeling to be just paranoia from my head injury, to remember the cluster of Moriartys sharing space on our wall. I willed Bryony to just be an ordinary woman who took a job at Sherringford because of the pay and the beautiful campus, and because she didn't mind taking care of teenagers with the flu, not because she'd tracked Holmes and me across an ocean to frame us on Moriarty's orders. The knob turned. The door swung open.
I'm headed out, Nurse Bryony said softly. Can I get you anything?
No, thanks. Leave, I thought. Go home. But I heard her set down her bag. She padded into the room, smelling faintly of flowers. An ordinary, pretty girl smell. I swallowed hard. The room was beginning to sway, like a ship, and I wished badly that Holmes was still there.
You're nearly out of water.
Nurse Bryony refilled my glass at the sink and took another roll of crackers from the cabinet above, setting them both by my bed.
There. Go easy on these. I'm surprised you're not more nauseous.
I wondered if Dobson was nauseous before he died. I'd never had a concussion before. Was nausea a symptom? Was it a symptom of arsenic poisoning? That's it, I thought. Holmes can come up with the next plan. In the half-light, Bryony was a dark silhouette, all except the shining hair that fell across her face as she leaned down over me. She had a strange, hot electricity to her. I thought, in my confusion, that she might kiss me or slap me across the face, that she would pick up the pillow and smother me with it. But she put a cool hand to my forehead instead.
"Get some rest, Jamie, so you can see that girl of yours again tomorrow," she whispered, her breath hot on my face. "The other nurse will be in first thing." She gathered her things and left.
I didn't even try to sleep. Instead, I stayed up listening to the quiet clock of my heart, wondering every moment if I was about to stop breathing. I'd been careless with my life, I knew I was, but if I died tonight, I was going to be furious. I debated texting Holmes 1,000 times. If I was wrong, I'd look like an idiot. Around dawn, I threw the water glass to the floor, needing to hear something shatter. It was plastic. It bounced. When the morning nurse came in, an older woman with round Midwestern vowels, I was shivering with the effort to stay awake. But she washed and filled the same cup, gave me pills that matched the ones I'd taken earlier. She made some crack about how I looked as if I'd been chased through hell, and
I was overcome with a sensation that I was missing something. Something huge. When I finally got signed out of the infirmary, it was dinner time. Mrs. Dunham insisted on escorting me back to my room. "Now, get into bed," she said, waiting with crossed arms until I did. "I've already talked to Tom, and he's going to bring you something back from the dining hall. I want you to call me if you need anything, or if you start feeling terrible, and we'll get you right to the hospital." "Yes, Mrs. Dunham," I said unhappily. I was horribly ripe. I hadn't showered since before rugby practice, and starving, and ragged at the edges from my all-night vigil. I just wanted to be left alone. She bustled around, gathering extra blankets for my bed and picking Tom's clothes up from the floor. "I got special permission for an after-hours visit, if you'd like to see Charlotte." "Thanks. I don't really need anything else," I said, because she was genuinely sweet, and she wasn't showing any signs of leaving. "I love that you two are friends," she said. "Those stories were my favorite when I was younger." I smiled tightly at her. It was terrible, the way my stomach contracted at that sentence. I'd used to love hearing people talk about the Sherlock Holmes stories, and now I couldn't help making anyone who mentioned them to me into a suspect. They were mine, too. When Tom returned, he was juggling a sandwich, a pair of apples, and a cup of hot cocoa. "There you are," he said, arranging it all on my desk with a flourish. "I heard you ate it pretty hard at practice. Incredible catch, though, according to Randall." I tore into the sandwich. "How are you? How are things with Lena?" "She's good. What's Charlotte paying her off for? Lena's like rolling right now." "That's from poker," I said, mouth full. I wanted to leave the investigation behind at least long enough to get through dinner. "Well, are you and Charlotte still prime suspects?" he asked, pulling over a chair. I shrugged. It hurt to. "Can we talk about something else? What did I miss in my history class? I got all my other assignments." His face fell. "Nothing, really," he said, and waited as if he expected me to cave and tell him all about my adventures. I wished he knew how stressful and humiliating those adventures actually were. It wasn't my job to educate him on that, though, so I let the conversation die, crunching into one of the apples he'd brought. Eventually, Tom gave up on me. Holmes swung by an hour later. Thankfully, I'd had a chance to shower. "How's the patient?" she asked as she perched on the edge of my bed. I was always suspicious of Holmes in a good mood. "Has someone else been killed?" I asked, only half-joking. She smiled at me. "Better? Try again." Without turning around, Tom tugged out one of his earbuds, then the other. I don't know why it annoyed me so much, his clumsy attempt at spying. Maybe I was done being grist for the gossip mill. I lifted an eyebrow in his direction to tip Holmes off, but she'd already noticed. She whipped out her phone. "I've got a date," she announced, texting furiously. My phone lit up silently on the bed between us, and I craned my neck to see. "Apparently Wheatley's brother keeps snakes in New Jersey." "Where'd you find the guy? Craigslist? The sewers?" "Any missing?" I texted back. "Shepherd's running it down." "Funny, you're funny. Look, I thought tomorrow you could help me write a poem for him. Maybe show it to Mr. Wheatley tomorrow after class, get his opinion. Interrogate him." "Why don't you?" "Love poems? It sounds serious." "Oh, quiet. He's dreamy." "Because you're his student. He doesn't know me." She swung her legs off the bed. Furtively, she fished a chocolate bar out of her coat pocket and slid it onto the desk. It was a Cadbury flake. She must have ordered it online. I don't know how she knew it was my favorite. "Feel better," she said, smiling crookedly at me, and then slipped out of the room. Tom stuck his earphones back in with a sigh. "So you didn't find anything on Nurse Bryony?" I texted her. "No, science is 4:42 at lunch." I heard her footsteps retreating down the hall. We'll make a plan for Wheatley then.
I lingered by Mr. Wheatley's desk after class, waving an inquisitive-looking Tom on to his next class. I had a free period at the end of the day, so I wasn't in a rush. Wheatley was talking to one of our class's better poets, a shy, small girl who wrote exclusively about communing with nature in her native Michigan. As I waited, he gave her a series of book recommendations in his meandering, sleepy voice, and she scribbled them down. Our journals were identical. I tucked mine discreetly back in my bag, feeling a little cliché, and tried to focus on remembering the strategy that Holmes and I had hammered out at lunchtime. Finally, he turned to me.
"Ah, Mr. Watson," he said to me. "What can I do for you?"
I shuffled my feet. "I wanted to talk to you about my poems," I told him. "I'm having some trouble putting them together. They're a lot harder than stories. I was wondering if you had any books I could borrow to do some outside reading." He nodded thoughtfully.
"I have something in my office I could lend you. Follow me."
Wheatley's office was the kind of book-lined cave that, in other circumstances, I would have let myself get lost in. There was a hooded copper lamp on his desk that spotlit a stack of our manuscripts, and I recognized my most recent short story on the top. In the corner, a stand-up globe was turned so that a dusty Europe faced out. I sat gingerly in a chair and took a harder look around. I didn't have the facility for observation that Holmes had. I knew that. But I'd always liked cataloging the details of a place and its people, using it as grist for my stories. Maybe that interest was more about romanticizing my surroundings than deducing from them, but it still spurred me to look closely at the authors of the books on his shelves. Kafka, Rumi, some Scandinavian mystery writers, the kind of rug on his floor. It had a folksy, hand-woven feel, the kind of coffee he was drinking. He'd brought it from home in a stainless steel mug. I'd been too muddled and, frankly, scared to look that closely at Nurse Bryony when I was in the infirmary. I was determined to have more to show for my efforts this time. Wheatley hummed to himself as he ran his finger along a bookshelf. Though he was a nervous teacher, a pacer, a hand-wringer who started each sentence two or three times, he seemed at ease now in his office, and I wondered if it was the confidence of a man who knew he had me in his power. Or maybe he just liked me and was more comfortable speaking one-on-one. It was impossible for me to tell. I wish that Holmes were there. "Found them," he said, pulling a few books from the shelf to hand to me.
"There's a book of poetry prompt, in case you'd like to practice, and a collection of essays by contemporary poets that you might find useful in thinking about the impetus for writing a poem."
"Thanks," I tucked them in my bag.
"Your fiction is good, as I told you at homecoming," he said. "Clean and sharp and very readable. Some of your plots are a bit far-fetched, but I don't mind the wish-fulfillment aspect of it. I think it runs in your blood, maybe. I read all your great-great-whatever-grandfather's stories when I was a boy."
"Wonderful. The movie adaptations from the 30s were very good, too." I'd always hated those films. They'd portrayed Dr. Watson as a bumbling idiot and Sherlock Holmes as an automaton. But I saw my opening and took it. "They're great, aren't they? My favorite is the one about the snake, the speckled band."
"Ah, I know that story," Mr. Wheatley shuddered. "I hate snakes. My brother keeps them on his farm, and I make him visit me. Can't do it. After I heard what happened to that Dobson boy, I couldn't sleep for days."
His distress seemed genuine, but I couldn't be sure. "He was attacked by a snake?" I asked innocently.
"After he died," Mr. Wheatley said. "I'm surprised you don't know. Didn't the police talk to you about it?"
"They talked to you about it?" He squirmed a little in his chair. It was strange to see an adult act so squirrely.
"I keep a close tab on the news. I have a friend on the force. You know."
I could tell he was lying, but it didn't mean I knew what the truth was.
"That reminds me," I said, trying a different tack. "I wanted to know about how to write from our lives. Especially when things get weird and unbelievable. Can you still do it? Write about them? You talk a lot about how we need to write from our own experiences, but when awful things happen...
You can talk to me about it if you need to, he cut in. It might help you organize your thoughts. You could even write me a story about it, for extra credit. After all, you've skipped almost a week's worth of classes.
I looked at my hands, wondering what he'd try to get out of me. It might be useful to play along. Also, I could use the extra credit.
Sure, I could try that, I said.
He pulled a legal pad out from under the stack of papers on his desk and balanced it on his knee.
So, he said, lifting a page or two and sliding a piece of cardboard beneath it. What are you finding so unbelievable?
Well, I said, it's a little weird that my best friend is a Holmes. I never really expected that to happen.
Hmm, he said, making a note. Tell me more about your relationship with Charlotte Holmes.
Even though I'd led him to the topic, I still found his tone obnoxious. I gritted my teeth.
Like I said, she's my best friend. And yet you went to the dance together. She could have more complicated feelings. It's important to consider these kinds of things, he said, slipping into teacher mode. For character development.
If anyone had complicated feelings, it was me, and those were none of his fucking business. We're talking about Charlotte Holmes here. I think she has complicated relationships even with the skeletons in her lab. Nothing is straightforward to her.
I thought I'd dodged the question, but his eyes lit up. She keeps skeletons in her office, he said, scribbling it down. Interesting.
Her lab, I corrected him. Too late, I remembered what Holmes had taught me about how easy it is to get people to correct you.
Where's her lab? He asked, not looking at me.
I can't remember, I lied. She doesn't let anyone in there.
Very private, he said. Good. She has kind of a goth look to her, doesn't she? Is it cultivated, do you think?
Holmes wears what she wants to wear, like I do. I frowned. She's not some agent of death, or a cartoon. I always thought she looked very London, that's all. I don't understand how this would help me write this story.
Character development, he repeated. Tell me, when she investigates, does she behave much like her famous forebear?
Sherlock, I asked. I don't know, I haven't exactly met him in the flesh.
Mr. Wheatley laughed, then abruptly stopped. No, really, does she?
It went on for a long time. I let him draw me out, bit by bit, noting carefully to hear where he directed the conversation. I told him that I'd been struggling to write down the story of Dobson's death and the police's investigation into my life, but Mr. Wheatley didn't want to talk about Dobson at all. I took it as a sign that he already knew all there was to know about that poor boy and his murder. And though everyone on campus knew now that Holmes and I had found Elizabeth unconscious in the quad, he didn't even ask about her either. But Holmes, Mr. Wheatley wanted to know everything, about her childhood, about her older brother, whose name he readily knew, about the circumstances of her coming to Sherringford. Thankfully, my own knowledge of her was patchwork enough that I could plead ignorance, but it was all incredibly damning, watching him write down her whole dossier. Why could he possibly want that information except to use it against us? That is, until he ripped the sheet he'd been writing on from his legal pad and handed it over to me. I stared at it for a minute, not understanding.
There. Sometimes it helps to say it all aloud before you start shaping your piece. But it all sounds very hard to deal with, Jamie, like I'd said before.
He leaned over to scribble something at the top of the paper.
If you'd prefer to talk to someone else, here's the name of the school therapist. She's very kind, and you shouldn't be ashamed about making an appointment. Most people eventually do.
I folded the sheet and put it in my pocket, feeling distinctly ashamed. He'd just been trying to help after all, if a little ham-handedly. Mr. Wheatley was a good man, and he was concerned about me, and still I had been imagining him to be out for my blood, wondering if he had lowered that rattlesnake onto Dobson's convulsing form. Was this what it was always like, doing detective work? How could you ever let yourself get close to anyone? No wonder Holmes was so determined to keep herself apart. When I left Wheatley's office, I went straight to Sciences 442. It had only taken an hour alone for Holmes to trash her lab. The carpet was an explosion of open file folders, their pages spread out like snow. Something bright green was frothing over on a Bunsen burner, and the entire room smelled of cilantro. In the midst of all this chaos, Holmes was slumped on the floor in her uniform like a black and white bird, smoking a cigarette and reading The History of Dirt. It was so gigantic that she had to brace it against her knees. Above her, the vulture skeletons swung lazily on their strings. During one of our marathon research sessions, I decided to name them Julian and George, and today, Julian's skull sported a small knife that looked as if it had been stabbed there. I shuddered. "Your book looks great," I said, picking a path across the room. "What's the sequel, Worms and You?" "Don't tease. I know nothing about American soils. And the idea of tracing a murder victim by the contents of their shoe soles is hardly far-fetched." She turned a page, and I could see that she was incredibly tense. "You sound disappointed. You don't suspect Wheatley, then?"
"I don't," I said. "Or Nurse Bryony. Or maybe I suspect both of them because we have a disappeared dealer, and I want someone concrete to suspect. I'm in some muddled state where I can't tell what I think."
"It's because you care," she said, "about nearly everyone. It's remarkable, really, but in this instance it clouds your judgment. It's why I try to avoid sentiment."
"That's heartless," I said, stung. All this time, had I been nothing more to her than someone to carry her bag?
"I said I try to avoid it. Do keep up." She shut her book and fixed her lantern eyes on me. "Trust me, if Milo were involved in a murder plot, I'd find it very difficult to assist him. It's not heartlessness if it saves lives." She was spoiling for a fight, but I made myself back down. I thought of the Cadbury flake on my desk, the time she leaned over to straighten my glasses in the middle of a conversation. She was either much better or much worse at this whole caring business than she thought. "Wheatley's getting information about the two of us somewhere, and he's definitely watching you closely."
"That surprises you?" she asked. I bit back a remark about her being the center of the universe.
"Well, yes. No. I don't know. He also seems genuinely afraid of snakes," I said, wanting to defend him, "and genuinely concerned with what's happening to me."
"I'd suspect him less if he seemed indifferent," Holmes pointed out.
"Did he try to dig into your oh-so-compelling trauma?"
"No," I paused. "Well, a little. He referred me to a therapist."
"Psychology," she snorted.
"All the same."
I threw up my hands.
"What about the other names on the suspects list? You know, the ones who aren't Romanian royalty or pop stars?
The Moriartys. What about August? Is he really dead?"
"Nothing to report." Holmes drew on her cigarette, her eyes narrowing.
"Honestly, sod all this. None of this is correct. We have the data and the access, but we've made no progress. I've smoked at least 20 of these horrible things today, and I'm developing a wretched dependency. Just you watch. We'll be out in the middle of some sodding field watching a perfectly captivating murder take place firsthand, and I'll have to run off in the middle because I need to have a lucky strike right then, or I'll be the one doing the killing."
She stabbed out her cigarette against the love seat's arm, and in the same gesture lit another. I'd heard her run off on tangents before, but none this frustrated or angry.
"Then stop. Smoking."
"Do you really want me to revert to the alternative?" she snapped.
"Maybe we should take the night off," I said. "Go get pancakes. Plan for tomorrow."
I could have blamed myself for having wound her up in the first place, but Holmes had been itching for a confrontation from the moment I walked through the door.
The look she gave me then was the one you saved for cockroaches, shoe in hand. This is what I do. You want me to stop? You think you can talk about it like it's a game? The acid in her tone ate away the last of my patience. I'm saying that you should take a night off, not that you should abandon it completely. You can't handle the pace, then. No! God, if we're so stuck, why won't we just call in your parents? I refuse to have them involved. Don't you think that getting your head on straight can take priority, for once, to proving yourself to your family? She pulled herself up, as proud and straight as an ancient queen. Her face was a perfect blank. The only glimmer of Holmes I could see was in the anger darkening her eyes. Yes, she said in a flat voice. I hadn't thought of that. I, of course, have no personal stake in this matter, since this is all an exercise to please my parents. Holmes. So yes, take the night off. In the meantime, I'll be tracking down the person who murdered my rapist and tried to murder your little girlfriend and then almost had us arrested for it. It might even move faster without you, as you've proven yourself so extraordinarily useless. It was the first time she'd ever said anything that cruel to me. The word useless hung between us like a millstone on a piece of thread. How can I help you, I snarled, when you keep so much information to yourself? There's a Moriarty plastered all over that wall that you refuse to talk about. You've told me nothing about your relationship with him. With him? Don't you mean to him? She asked. Is this about the case or your jealousy? Her hand flew up to her mouth, as if to stop the words from coming out. But it was too late. Okay, then. There was nothing else to say. I put my coat on, not sure where I was headed, but knowing that it was somewhere the hell away from here. Watson! Holmes got to her feet. I'm fine. I know I can be perfectly beastly. You can, I said. And why don't you just call me Jamie, like everyone else, since I'm too useless to be your Watson? Holmes's mouth opened and snapped shut. I slammed the door hard enough that, behind me, I heard the satisfying crash of a beaker shattering on the floor. 8. I paced outside of Michener Hall, blowing on my hands to keep them warm. By the time I banged through the front door, I was mostly in control of myself again. Mrs. Dunham was manning the front desk. Did she ever go home? But I walked straight past her without a word, not wanting to test my hard-won composure. Usually, my room was empty the hour before dinner, but that day Tom was watching a video on his computer, eating a chocolate bar. On the screen, a girl performed a burlesque routine to a song sung in French. I recognized a few of the words. Leave it, leave it all. Biting her lip, she lowered one strap, the other. Are you okay? Tom asked, hitting pause. The girl in the video froze obediently. Fine, I said. Bad day. You don't seem to have a lot of good ones, he observed. There was a smear of chocolate on his Argyle sweater vest, and I realized the wrapper on his desk was from the flake bar Holmes had given me. It shouldn't have been a big deal. Tom and I had standing permission to raid each other's food stashes, within reason, but I took it like a blow to the gut. I don't see why that's shocking, considering, I said, and willed him to go away. Ever since I'd come to Sherringford, I'd existed in a state of constant loneliness without ever actually being alone. Privacy was an illusion at boarding school. There was always another body in the room, and if there wasn't, one could enter at any moment. Being Holmes's friend might have taken the edge off that loneliness, but it didn't dissipate entirely. At best, our friendship made me feel as though I was a part of something larger, something grander. That with her, I'd been given access to a world whose unseen currents ran parallel to ours. But at our friendship's worst, I wasn't sure I was her friend at all. Maybe some human echo chamber or a conductor for her brilliant light. I hadn't realized I was thinking out loud until Tom cleared his throat. I had a friend like that once, he said. Oh, I said, uninterested. But Tom had a thoughtful expression on, and I didn't want to be cruel. "Andrew," he said. He was the only person I really kept in touch with after I left for Sherrinford, and last summer, we hung out all the time. He's this all-state football star, and he always gets perfect grades, and I swear he could get away with murder because of it. Because 90% of the time he was so good, he could stay out all night downtown, partying. He'd come in at dawn, and his parents would just buy that he was out late studying. I felt invincible when I was around him. "What happened?" I asked. "Cops caught us drinking down by the lake, and he pinned the whole thing on me." Tom flashed a self-deprecating smile. "His family is like a big deal. They have all this money, and we don't, not anymore, so they got the charges dropped. But I was in the doghouse for months. The worst part of it was that he stopped talking to me. If anything, I should have been the one who got to tell him to eat shit." "I'm sorry." It was hard to imagine Tom being on anyone's bad side. He was the guy who could wear a baby blue suit to homecoming and still have one of the hottest girls in school as his date. "It's not worth it being the sidekick," he said. "I bet she just uses you to do her dirty work. Andrew used to do that to me." "Sometimes," I said, hiding how close to the bone that cut. He gave me a knowing look. "So she doesn't even let you do that?" "No," I snapped. "She trusted me to sniff out Mr. Wheatley, and I went out and got a fucking concussion because no one would investigate the school nurse. I don't call that doing nothing." Tom looked like I'd hit him. "You what?" "All right, it was stupid, and I couldn't have planned it exactly. Maybe I would have broken my arm or twisted my ankle, but I couldn't exactly fake having to stay in the infirmary all day, could I? How else could Holmes have snuck in there without breaking in? The door's alarmed. They keep everyone's medicine in there." "No, I..." He was casting around for words, but none were coming. Did he really think that I was so useless I couldn't help her out at all? "I didn't know you were that stupid," he said finally. "Thanks, you twat." "Don't mention it," he said. "Look, I'm meeting Lena for dinner, so I gotta go. I'm doing some work at the library after that, but we can talk more about your life choices tonight if you want to." Tom and Lena. Mine and Holmes's shadow selves. Or maybe we were the shadows, and they the happy, well-adjusted versions. "Don't worry about it," I said. "I'm fine." After throwing some books in his bag, he took off. He must have bumped the keyboard as he went, though, because the video he'd been playing unpaused. The girl on the screen began shimmying out of her clothes again. I plunked down in Tom's chair and closed the window, then sat there for a minute, staring at the notes Tom had pinned above his desk, the tiny mirror he'd put there. That's when I noticed it. His desk and mine were across from each other, meaning that most nights we did our homework back to back. The only mirror in our room had been clumsily hung to the right of where I sat, its bottom half obscured by my desk. If I sat up in the middle of the night, I'd catch a glimpse of my reflection and panic that we had an intruder. That was more or less all that mirror was good for. I didn't mind that much. I cared a bit about what I wore on the weekend, but our school uniform was exactly that, a uniform, and so the way I looked in it didn't change. Tom, on the other hand, wore all kinds of product in his hair, and rather than lean awkwardly over my desk to apply it, or do it in the bathroom, which he claimed was embarrassing, as if he'd be dispelling some notion that his boy band mop grew in that way, he tacked up a locker-sized mirror above his desk. All this is to say that when I looked up into Tom's mirror, I was at the precise angle to see that there was a gap between my own mirror and the wall. A small gap, a centimeter. In that centimeter's worth of dark, I could see the glimmer of a reflection. Something was back there. I walked over, got down on my knees, made blinkers with my hands to block the overhead light. Still, I couldn't make out what was behind it. After straightening a wire hanger from my closet, I rattled it in the gap in an attempt to dislodge whatever was back there. I hit on nothing, even when I ran it from top to bottom. When I looked again, I could still see the glimmer of light reflecting off something. Was it a lens? I took a deep breath and tried to gather my thoughts. On the bed, my phone buzzed, and I seized it, thinking it might be Holmes. It would be a relief. We'd both been horrible to each other. We'd both been keyed up and defeated and lost. I couldn't imagine what being lost felt like for someone as whip-smart as Charlotte Holmes, and I refused to believe that she'd meant what she'd said. It had to be her. She'd come right over. Everything would be fine. But the text was from my mother, asking if I'd forgotten our weekly call. She'd try again later tonight, she said, and signed it with kisses. I looked back into the gap. The light was still shining. Someone had been in here. Someone had put this thing in my room. In a sudden, towering wave of rage, I jerked the desk away from the wall, scattering my textbooks in the process. Standing in the space I'd cleared, I braced both my hands against the mirror and pulled. It refused to give. I planted my feet, trying to remember what Coach Q had taught us about taking down a bigger opponent, and pulled harder. Harder. There was a faint cracking sound, probably its bolts beginning to pull from the plaster, but it still refused to move. Panting, I stared at my reflection. My eyes were all pupil, my face sweaty and red. I looked how I did at the end of a rugby match, like a Neanderthal. Fine, I'd be a Neanderthal. With a grunt, I picked up my chemistry text from the desk and slammed it into the mirror. It didn't give on the first try, or the second. Around the 10th, I stopped counting and instead watched the webbed crack grow from the middle of the mirror to its edges. Outside in the hall, someone yelled, "What the hell is going on?" But I ignored them. It wasn't hard to. The mirror may have been sturdily constructed, but like all things made of glass, it eventually gave. There was a great loud splintering crack as it broke, and I spun away, throwing the textbook up to shield my face. It hadn't shattered out so much as down, but some pieces had flown out and stuck into the flesh of my hands. I was in such a fury that I couldn't feel them there. Because when I turned to look, I saw a small, circular lens, the size of my thumbnail, with a cord that ran into a wireless device. It had been adhered to the wall with a bit of tape. But how could the camera capture anything through the mirror? I bent and gingerly picked up one of its larger pieces. I'm not sure why I bothered. My hands were already bleeding, and turned it front to back. Both sides appeared to be glass. A two-way mirror. What came next I can only describe as a fugue state. I'd understood what it was to lose myself in the past, when I'd been in a rage, but this time the feeling was coupled with crippling fear and violation. Someone had seen me get dressed. Someone had seen me sleep. And though I couldn't find a microphone on the camera, I was sure that this someone had also recorded every word I'd said. So there had to be an audio recording device as well. I tore the books off my shelf, dumped out my desk drawers, went through every pocket of every pair of trousers hanging in my closet. I took my Swiss Army knife and cut open my mattress, not caring about the fine I'd have to pay, and searched every inch of it with my bleeding fingers. I got on my hands and knees and pulled up the carpet in our room, inch by inch, using the knife to help me along. I cut open the curtains, then looked down the hollow rod that held them up, and I adamantly ignored the noise in the hall that had now increased to a fever pitch. A fist was pounding on the door, and a voice that sounded like Mrs. Dunham's shouted, "Jamie! Jamie, I know you're in there!" But I'd already shoved Tom's desk chair under the doorknob and thrown the deadbolt. It was easy to turn the volume for the outside world all the way down, what with a screaming panic in my head. When all was said and done, I'd come up with two electronic bugs, each the size and shape of my thumbnail. One had been affixed to the wall-facing side of my headboard. The other I found on the bottom of my desk chair. I held them in my cupped hands, striping them with blood. Their data must have been sent to the transmitter wirelessly, because they weren't attached to anything with any cords that I could see. I set them down on my desk in a neat line, along with the camera which I'd yanked the cord from. Then I threw them into a pillowcase. If they were still transmitting, the spy on the other end would be looking into a black screen. I heard a buzzing sound. Was it from blood loss? Not unlikely. My room looked as if some howling, wounded beast had ripped it up with its claws. Everything I owned was on the floor. A good deal of it tracked red from my hands, and I hadn't even searched through Tom's things yet. I'd been able to control myself that much, to wait until he returned, but there was still the problem of the bugs. What to do with them? I thought woozily that I should call the detective. I should call Holmes. Come to think of it, there was still shouting in the hall. Was I imagining it? My name. Jamie? Jamie? Jamie! Go away, I hollered, and eased myself down into the chair. I was beginning to feel the cuts on my hands, the glass that I'd pushed still further into the skin with each new thing I'd rifled through or discarded. I should go to the infirmary, I thought, but I didn't want to tip anyone off. Anyone who hadn't already heard the commotion, that is, and Nurse Bryony was still sharing space with Mr. Wheatley on my no-fly list. I hunted through my shaving kit for a pair of tweezers, put a t-shirt between my teeth, and got down to the business of pulling out the glass. It wasn't sanitary, God knows, but it also hadn't been a good day for making decisions. "You don't seem to have a lot of good ones," Tom had said. He wasn't wrong. I nearly bit through the cloth, trying not to scream, but I didn't manage to keep myself from crying. It wasn't so much from sadness or pain as acceptance of the impossible, a great well of "this is wrong" bubbling up all at once. I wondered absently if the transmitters on my desk were picking up the sound. One more shameful thing in with all the rest. I resisted the urge to smash the audio bugs like the insects they were. I'd need them as evidence, after all. What I didn't understand was why they'd bugged my room. Who was I, anyway? I wasn't the extraordinary one. I was Jamie Watson, would-be writer, subpar rugger, keeper of the most boring journal in at least 5 states. I couldn't even get people to call me by my full first name. If I was important, it was only as a conduit. Holmes's only access point. What information had I revealed unwittingly in this room? What had I given away? With a growing sense of horror, I realized that I'd given away plenty, even some that day. Mr. Wheatley, the faked concussion, the search through Bryony's things. I'd said all of it out loud. I'd spent the week after the murder telling Tom about all our suspicions and our findings, what we'd found in Dobson's room. I'd even bitched about August Moriarty. God, how stupid could I have possibly been? By now, I was sure they knew I'd found their bugs. I needed to get over to Sciences 442 and sweep our lab, to see if Holmes could trace the signal. If she couldn't, I knew that Milo could, and I knew he wasn't more than a phone call away. The shirt I'd been wearing was ruined, smeared with blood and bits of glass. I stripped it off and shook it out before I tore it into makeshift bandages for my hands. The knots I'd made would hold, but not for long. Maybe we could steal Lena's car keys again and go to the hospital. We, I kept thinking, we. I knew she'd forgive me. She had to. Without each other, we could quite literally die. I put on a clean shirt and flung open the door, only to trip over Mrs. Dunham. She'd slouched down against the wall outside my room, legs kicked out before her. It was clear from her face that she was crying.
"Jamie," she said hoarsely.
I knelt down beside her.
"What have you done to yourself? Look at your hands and your face. Are you hurt? I heard the worst noises coming from your room."
"I didn't mean to scare you," I told her.
"I'm fine. Everything's fine."
That phrase was beginning to sound meaningless. She leaned over to look inside my room and pulled back in shock.
"Oh, Jamie, what have you done?"
"I've got to go," I said. "But I'll explain later, I promise. I've got to find Holmes." She grabbed at my hand to keep me from leaving, and I bit back a yell of pain.
"I guess that means you haven't heard," she said, and her eyes misted over with tears. "Oh, Jamie, I didn't want to be the one to tell you, but there's been an accident.
A horrible, horrible accident. Mrs. Dunham said it had only happened 10 minutes before. Had it only been 10 minutes since I found that camera, it could have been seconds or years for all I could tell, and that campus was being evacuated building by building. Mishner Hall was empty except for the two of us. She'd thought I'd destroyed my room on hearing the news, because she, unlike everyone else, knew where Holmes's main haunt was. They were blaming it on a gas explosion, she'd said. I'd pelted across campus at a dead run. It was beginning to snow, a powder dusting that clung to my bare arms and the bandages on my hands. I'd forgotten my coat, my phone. My heart beat harder as I got to the quad. From clear across campus, I could see that the sciences building was a smoking ruin. My phone. Where was my phone? What if Holmes was trying to call me? What if she was trapped in the building somewhere? That was the worst possibility I'd allowed myself to imagine, that Julian and George's flightless bones had collapsed on top of her, but that she was fine underneath. A little sooty from the smoke, perhaps, but fine. But then, I wasn't giving her enough credit. Holmes was a magician. She had to be standing outside, whole and hale and intact, smoking a cigarette as she watched it all burn. Most important, she'd be alive. Still furious with me. I'd give the universe that. She could never want to speak to me again for all I cared, so long as she was alive. All of that went straight from my mind when I saw it. It wasn't possible. The northwest corner of sciences was blown clear through. The corner where Holmes's supply closet was. Battered pieces of granite had thudded mightily to the ground. Through the smoke, I could see the building's interior walls, tattered and stacked like the pages of an old book lit with a match. Here and there, bits of broken wall were still smoldering. Somewhere in the distance, sirens sounded. Uniformed police officers were cordoning off the area, pushing the few bystanders back into a huddled mass of winter coats. Over a bullhorn, a voice ordered any remaining students to report to the union for further instructions. An officer had set up a standing light that sharply illuminated the building's entrance. There would be a thorough search, he was saying. The firemen would pull out any survivors. Survivors. I pushed past him, and the other officer waving a pair of plastic flares, and then past a yellow-suited fireman. There were fire engines behind me now, flashing their lights, who snagged me by the arm. The look I turned on him must have been that of a feral dog, because he loosened his grip for the half-second it took me to shake him off. I took off in a sprint toward the front door, and was instantly tackled to the ground. They wrestled me back toward the emergency vehicles, where they assigned an officer to be my babysitter and made me sit under his watchful eye on the edge of the fire engine. They didn't want to arrest me, they said, but they would if I tried to take off again. So I sat dully while the red lights washed everything with fire. At some point, the officer, in a moment of compassion, pressed a cup of something hot into my bandaged hands. He tried to convince me to put on his jacket, but I wanted his pity even less than I wanted his attention. Possibly I insulted his mother. I couldn't remember. He kept away from me after that. I wondered what Holmes's funeral would be like. I felt sick for a while, and then I stopped really feeling anything at all. Someone must have taken my wallet from my pocket or done some calling around, because suddenly my father was there at my elbow. He led me to his car where the heater was running full blast, and said something about taking me to the hospital. My hands. I'd forgotten about my hands. They were the first words of his I'd registered. No. I felt my body come alive with terror. No, Dad. Someone is after us, and I can't go to the hospital. I have to find Holmes. Don't you see? I can't tell you until I know it's safe, but there's something very wrong going on, and I need her. I need her here. Do you understand? I can only imagine what I must have looked like, half mad with terror and grief and covered in my own blood, ranting at him from the passenger seat. But my father did an amazing thing. He put the car into park. Slowly, as if he might scare me into flight, he reached over to cup the back of my head.
I understand, he said. For now, let's just go home. He put it into drive and turned on the headlights, and there she was, standing in their white glow. Holmes' skin was smoked black from the explosion, her hair flecked with snow. Her violin dangled from her fingers. She opened her mouth, and I saw her say my name. I was out of the car in a heartbeat, and in the next she was in my arms. Holmes was always Holmes, even after a terrible shock. With the utmost care, she reached around me to place her Stradivarius on the sedan's purring hood. Only once it was secure did she allow herself to be held, and even then she kept her palms on my chest as if to brace herself. She was slight and freezing cold. Her posture, as always, was perfect. "You're alive," I murmured, tucking my head over hers. "I'm so sorry." For once she didn't chide me for stating the obvious. Instead, she let out a long, shuddering breath. "The only thing I saved was my Strat, and I had to go back in for it. Watson, I was in the bathroom, and if I hadn't been, the bomb was planted in our lab." I laughed hollowly. "They're saying it's a gas explosion." She shifted to look up into my face. "A homemade bomb, and in our lab. There was shrapnel stuck in the walls. Watson," she kept returning to my name. "I assume you look such a mess because you've found wire taps in your room, and not because you've taken up cage fighting." The cut hands, I guessed, seizing on this chance to feel normal. "And what else?" "The fact that you're stuck all over with glass like some porcupine. Camera behind the mirror, and then, of course, you look for the audio, which made you feel both personally wronged and suspicious. If you don't trust someone, your left eye twitches at the corner. Right now it's happening every 3 seconds. By looking at the kinds of mud on your shoes, it'd only take moments to trace your route from Mishnah." I pulled her back up against me, and she battered my chest with ineffective fists. "You are doing this to shut me up," she complained. "I am," I said, and she began to cry. I backed off. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to." "It's not you. This is horrifying," she said through her tears. "I'm not in the least sad. Why am I crying?" My father bundled us together in the back seat under a moth-eaten blanket. I insisted that we wrap her Strad in another. I tucked her under my arm, and she wept quietly the whole way. Abby, my father's wife, had made up the guest room, and after we arrived, Holmes took a cursory look at the bugs from my dorm room, pronounced them dead, and put herself straight to bed. While my father went to call the school, my stepmother pulled me aside to ask where she should put the inflatable mattress. "Are you having sex with her?" Abby asked, and promptly looked mortified. "I'm sorry. I'm not used to teenagers, and I can't believe the first thing I've ever said to James's son is... I don't really know how to... Are you two having sex?" "We're not," I assured her. Bizarrely, this was proving the perfect way for us to meet, unscheduled, without expectations. I didn't have the energy to hate her. Honestly, I couldn't feel anything except tempered relief. Holmes was safe, if in shock. We were being looked after, if only for a night, and Abby had an open, charming face with a spray of freckles across her nose, and I was so tired. I decided to just get it over with and start liking her. "Then I'm putting you in with Charlotte," she said. "So don't start tonight. Having sex, I mean. And your nose is blue. Are you hypothermic? Go run yourself a hot bath." Upstairs, I peeled off my makeshift bandages in the bathroom sink. I had to soak in the tub with my hands resting over the sides so I wouldn't bleed into the water. Afterward, I put on some of my father's old sweats and let Abby lead me down to the kitchen table. After giving me some Advil, she cleaned out the wounds in my hands with antiseptic and with a pair of tweezers she'd sterilized, took out the rest of the glass shards under my skin. Then she got to work on my scalp. I clamped my mouth shut to keep from yelling. My father came in halfway through the process. He'd been on hold all that time as Sherrinford's lines were jammed with panicked parents calling in. Finally, the school had sent out a mass email.
He read it off to us there at the table. There hadn't been any casualties from the gas leak, thank God, though the physics teacher had been in his lab and suffered minor injuries, but Sherrinford was shut down for the rest of the semester. It's about time, I thought. My father kept reading something about rescheduled finals and incompletes, but I didn't pay much attention.